Back in December, I introduced you to a man named Hugh Montgomery, who is author of the book Bureaucratic Nirvana, Life in the Center of the Box, and the preface to that book written by James Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence. And at the conclusion of my conversation with Hugh, he said, you know, you should get on your show. You should have Jim Woolsey come on the show. He would love to talk about all kinds of things, especially alternative energy sources and energy conservation. I said I would love to do it, and I'm fortunate that today is the day that I welcome former CIA Director James Woolsey to the studio. Sir, it's great to have you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you for coming in today.
Sure.
How did you get so involved in alternative energy as kind of your passion? It's not necessarily what someone might think of when they think of someone who's spent his life in service.
I still remember it was October of 1973. I was general counsel of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I was supposed to help run some hearings that day, and I was late getting to work because I'd spent an hour and a half sitting in a gas line because in the middle of the war, the Saudis had cut off our oil because we were trying to ship Israel enough to keep it from being overrun by its neighbors. And I got a bad case of clenched teeth that day, and they've stayed clenched on this oil issue for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, I've come to be interested also in electricity generation, some of the problems and issues connected with that. But oil, getting away from oil, I've been writing about and speaking about and doing things on for a couple of 3 decades.
Mm-hmm. Some folks who have been paying attention to these issues for a long time, and some of us who've been around town for a long time, remember the policy implications that went along with those gas lines in the 70s. Why do you think it's taken 30, 35, maybe more years for people to really start paying attention to this and for action to start happening? I recall back then people starting to talk about, wouldn't it be great if we could plug our cars into the wall? And the first electric cars are really just now rolling off the assembly lines. What's been the holdup, do you think?
Well, there are several things. First of all, some of these changes that people have gotten enthusiastic about, such as hydrogen, require huge investments in infrastructure. If you want a hydrogen pump at every filling station so you don't run out of hydrogen, if you've got a hydrogen-powered car, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of systems to convert natural gas to hydrogen, to pump and so forth. Electricity, much simpler. I drive a plug-in Prius. It's been converted to drive about 20, 25 miles on electricity, and I drive a Volt now as well. And both go, one goes about 20, one goes about 40 miles, all electric, before you need to use liquid fuel. And that's not an infrastructure problem. I plug both of them into the socket outside my garage.
Mm-hmm.
And because you can do, utilities can use time of day pricing the way they do for businesses. If they did it with residences, most people would charge their cars at night, and it doesn't really add, it won't for some time, to the need for added electric generating capability. But some of the steps have taken a lot of infrastructure, and that slowed things up. Another is that oil and automotive are two of the three or so largest industries in the world, and they've gotten very comfortable together without letting anything disrupt things. For example, if automobile companies made the fuel lines out of a slightly different kind of plastic, it costs maybe $50 to $100 added per car. Nothing compared to seat belts, or especially nothing compared to airbags. You could have an open standard, so-called flexible fuel system, so that not only ethanol but methanol made from natural gas could compete with gasoline. But oil and the automotive industry have a kind of a joint monopoly, and so they've been perfectly happy not to let alcohol fuels compete. So something that could be relatively quick like that, and Brazil has shown how quickly and effectively you can do it, give us a leg up on moving away from total oil dependence, because 95-96% of transportation is oil, and OPEC has close to 80% of the world's petroleum reserves, of conventional petroleum anyway. They're only pumping about 40% of the world's oil. The reason they're withholding so much is because they are a conspiracy and restraint of trade, and they're keeping the price up, so you and I have to pay close to, $4 a gallon,
mm-hmm.
For gasoline these days. I think that there are a number of reasons why we haven't been able to move as quickly as we should have away from petroleum dependence.
And in your view, where has this put us national security-wise, and where has it put us economically at a disadvantage?
Well, they're quite related. We borrow now over $1 billion a day to import oil. Hundreds of billions of that. Get shipped toward, as various presidents have put it, countries that don't like us very much. One example, Lawrence Wright in The Looming Tower, which is an excellent book on 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, says that with between 1% and 2% of the world's Muslims, the Saudis control about 90% of the world's Islamic institutions, including schools. And the aspect of Islam they teach to, let's say, little boys is not what the late great president of Indonesia, Abdurrahman Wahid, his movement would have taught, which was religious tolerance to other religions and the rest. They teach a very intense form of hatred for Christians and Jews, of lethal judgments against apostates and homosexuals, terrible repression of women, and to move toward a theocratic dictatorship called a caliphate for the world. It's essentially Al-Qaeda's doctrine. Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia don't disagree on substance. They disagree on who should be in charge, a little bit like the Trotskyites and the Stalinists back in the 20s and 30s. So if you're pulling into a filling station and you happen to ruminate on, I wonder who's paying for those little eight-year-old boys in Pakistan and the West Bank, and for that matter in some places in the U.S., to be taught that they really ought to, more than anything else, want to be suicide bombers. Before you get out to charge your gasoline and pump it, try to do what I try to remember to do. Turn the rearview mirror so it's a couple of inches so you're looking into your own eyes. And now you know the answer to the question of who's paying for those little boys to learn to want to be suicide bombers.
When it's framed in such stark terms, hard to argue with, first of all, when it's framed in such stark terms, it leads me to think, why aren't we then even more passionate about it? Why aren't we moving faster than we have since we have on 9/11?
I share the frustration. The administration... Really, the George W. Bush administration didn't move much on oil until late in his term. He did do some positive things in improving the CAFE standards and declaring oil to be an addiction and so forth. And then the Obama administration has focused mainly on electricity generation. It put a lot of its effort, most of it, into coming up with a cap and trade system for fixed sources of CO2 in order to deal with the global warming problem. The problem is that a cap-and-trade system of the sort they proposed and of the sort that the House of Representatives passed does almost nothing to get us off oil. $1 a ton added to the price of CO2, and in Europe it was about $20 a ton. So say $20 added to CO2 price in a cap and trade system adds about 20 cents to the cost of a gallon of gasoline. $1 a ton of CO2 is about a penny at the pump. And so even if that had gotten passed, it wouldn't have particularly done anything about oil. Politicians love to give speeches about oil dependence and say how serious it is, and then the proposals that they recommend to deal with it don't deal with it. Cap and trade didn't deal with it. Building nuclear power plants, or for that matter, wind farms, doesn't deal with it, because those are ways of generating electricity, and oil is about 1% of what we use for electricity. It's 95 to 96% of what we used for transportation, but it's about 1% of electricity generation. So the way you generate electricity is important. Clean is better than dirty. But it doesn't really have anything to do with moving us off oil. I think an open standard flexible fuel system and incentives to move fleet vehicles and maybe interstate trucking toward natural gas. I think alternative fuels, electrification. I drive a plug-in Prius and a Chevy Volt. Are promising, and I think improvements in internal combustion engines to increase efficiency, different types of valves and the like, some of which could be retrofitted into existing vehicles. Those are all things that don't require big infrastructure investments and on which we could move relatively quickly, but I don't see a lot of action out of either the Congress or the administration on them.
Let's talk a little bit when we come back from the break about what you foresee either the agencies or Congress's or the administration's role in advocating some of those things and driving some of those changes. My guest is James Woolsey, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Fried fish and stroke. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Fish is good for you, but researchers say you need to cook it right. A couple of meals a week of fish, especially those rich in omega-3 fatty acids, have been associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. However, at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, researcher Virginia Howard says frying may cook out omega-3s, and she says people in 8 southeastern states known as the Stroke Belt, where people are more likely to die from stroke, are more likely to eat their fish fried. So Dr. Howard says,
we need to increase our fish consumption, but we also need to find healthier ways to cook it. And there are many good ways, which is grilling and baking it, even microwave.
The study in the journal Neurology was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
George Komasolis is the acting chief information officer at the National Cancer Institute. He says the NCI usually shuts off access to Skype or other peer-to-peer sharing networks because of the security risks.
There are circumstances under which you get a waiver to have Skype, so that if a scientist needs to attend a meeting that is being held by Skype only, well, obviously we provide them with a waiver to use Skype if that meeting is required for their official duty.
CIOs and IT directors, are you paying for capacity services that you're not using? Take a good look at your capacity services contract, and next time, make sure you're not signing just another lease. Ask the experts. Vion Corporation. You can create a plan so that you only pay for what you use. When your job is on the line with data storage decisions, that's the way to go. With a 30-year partnership, Vion and Hitachi Data Systems have been bringing you innovative technologies with integrity and quality service. Visit Vion.com to learn more. That's Vion.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
The Obama administration is going to shut down a problematic virtual fence that was designed to guard parts of the U.S. border with Mexico. The project, being run by Boeing, involves video cameras, radar, sensors, and other technologies that were supposed to catch smugglers trying to sneak across the border. Benny Thompson, the senior Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee, said the SBI net program has been a grave and expensive disappointment. I'm J.J. Green.
Can you imagine being responsible for the electronic security of up to 1 billion barrels of emergency crude oil stored in salt caverns as deep as 4,000 feet? Airink can. Their advanced information management platform protects over $80 billion worth of crude oil for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The stockpile is so important to our national security that there's only one person in the world who can authorize its drawdown. For more information, log on to arinc.com.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for the Dorabeck Insider this afternoon. You're celebrating the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Well, this afternoon, we'll update you on the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. We'll tell you when it'll open, and we'll tell you what you can expect to see when it does open. And OMB, they laid out a 25-point plan to improve information technology. We'll have more on how you can implement some of those concepts this afternoon, 3 to 7, on the Dorabeck Insider. It's on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is former CIA Director James Woolsey. And we're talking about renewable energy and how it's being used in government. And we talked in the first segment, sir, about some of the challenges that the country has faced in getting to renewable energy sources like electric cars and so on. I'll call your attention to a Federal Times story from back in November. The General Services Administration has a solicitation out for 100 electric vehicles. They're choosing from among the Chevy Volt, the Nissan Leaf, and the Wego Life. All of which are just beginning production, and you got one of the first Volts. How do you like that car? I've seen them on TV. They look fantastic.
I like it a lot. It's and I think the Volt, which is not all electric, they call it range extended, electric vehicle with range extension, is a good compromise. If you try to go all electric, then either you have a very expensive car because the battery has to be so big,
mm-hmm.
or you have what's called range anxiety, and you got to keep wondering where you're going to plug in and mm-hmm. so forth. The nice thing about the Volt is you can go 40 miles, give or take a few miles, on the overnight charge of electricity, and you've got then liquid fuel in the tank, and you use it to run the generator to charge the battery.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an overall range of 300, 350 miles, just like you would in an all-gasoline car. But since on 3 days out of four, the average car in the U.S. goes under 40 miles, 3 days out of four, a Chevy Volt is an all-electric car. So I think it's a good compromise to deal with the so-called range anxiety problem.
A story I referenced in Federal Times talks about the solicitation for GSA to bring some of these in. It says the government's also supporting investment in electric cars and charging stations through the Recovery Act, about $330 million in funding and grants to cities, states, and private corporations to put about 13,000 electric vehicles and 20,000 chargers in cities across the country. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, a name that's been around for a long time, mm-hmm. Is partnering with one of those stimulus recipients. Is that the right kind of structure that you would like to see to solve some of the things that we talked about before?
It's a start. It gets the ball rolling. It's good for the government to help with charging stations and to buy electric or partially electric vehicles, I think. But I think the key thing is using the power of the government to break monopolies. The kind of fuel line that is in most American cars is a monopoly, constitutes a monopoly for oil products. And if you can break that and let other types of liquid fuels, methanol, ethanol, etc., compete with gasoline, the way happens in Brazil, you drive up to the pump and you just decide whether you want, look at the price, decide mm-hmm. whether you want ethanol or gasoline. That I think would do a great deal, and also mileage standards help because it gives an incentive for modifications to the internal combustion engine to get better mileage, and probably some type of tax credit for moving fleet vehicles, and probably interstate trucking. It wouldn't take too many installations of natural gas pumps to do that at truck stops. So I think those. Interstate trucking and especially fleet vehicles could be converted to operate on natural gas very quickly and
mm-hmm.
easily.
Potential targets for government action, not necessarily to force people to do mm-hmm. what they want to do, it sounds like you're advocating, but to facilitate, to help them make the business case to do so.
Break the barriers and let the market sort it out. If the market tilts toward methanol manufactured from natural gas rather than ethanol, rather than gasoline, then methanol wins.
Mm-hmm.
It's a battle of price and cost and skill in production, and it wouldn't take much of a change in infrastructure to have a pump at each filling station or most filling stations that mm-hmm. pumped ethanol and another one that pumped methanol.
Mm-hmm. Back to the issue of the agencies. The story also mentions the Postal Service's push to add electric vehicles to its fleet. They have over 200,000 vehicles in their fleet. We talked just in the first hour of the program, I featured the new Postmaster General, who is facing all kinds of financial difficulties. They're not necessarily in a position to invest widely in brand new vehicles to replace vehicles that are still functional, but it appears that they've devoted almost their entire refresh budget to vehicles of alternative sources. So the business case obviously makes sense to them.
I think it's making more and more sense all the time. For electricity, the batteries are getting cheaper and more efficient. Batteries were boring for the first one and a half to one and three quarter centuries of their existence. And over the course of the last few years, you've got these very bright young PhDs from places like MIT and Stanford and so forth starting battery companies. Mm-hmm. That wasn't happening a decade or 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're seeing a lot of improvement in electricity storage, and you'll see more. Helps. A lot of good R&D is being done on the alternative liquid fuels. It's not just a matter of corn ethanol. It's a matter of being able to use biodiesel that can be produced from algae, mm-hmm. for example. This is already starting to be used in small quantities for jet fuel, algae-produced jet fuel for the Navy, and plants that can grow in dry areas like Camelina or even more Hatropha that have good yields of oils but don't compete with agricultural products because nothing is going to compete with them out there in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of possibilities of incentivizing a move away from petroleum. And I think people have to recognize that there are these other reasons well beyond climate change. I think we ought to cut back on CO2 emissions too. But there are very good reasons to move toward biofuels and away from gasoline that are medical. For example, Boyden Gray, former counsel to first President Bush and then in second President Bush's ambassador to the EU, very scholarly, careful man, wrote a piece about 3 years ago, a long, detailed piece in the Texas Review of Law and Politics that spells out the medical problems from using the oil companies using aromatics, that is benzene, toluene, xylene, to enhance the octane in vehicles. It's cheap for them because these are byproducts of the refinery system, but they're highly carcinogenic. They're heavily regulated if they come out of a fixed facility. And Boyden puts the cost every year at something approaching $200 billion, with a B, dollars a year in tens of thousands of shortened lives and added medical costs. Now, people sometimes get upset saying we don't want to use ethanol. I would suggest that since 95% of the corn that's consumed in this country is consumed by animals, what you're doing is replacing cattle feed,
mm-hmm.
that usually is mainly used as starch to fatten cattle and give all of us more cholesterol. And rather than drive on the corn starch and turned into ethanol, if you drive on it, you're not giving people cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of arguments that I think need to be gotten out there for people to understand what's at issue by our staying on petroleum and petroleum products.
My guest is James Woolsey. He's the former director of Central Intelligence. My guest for the hour on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
NBC News Radio, I'm Pete Williams. Doctors in Arizona have more upbeat news about Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Dr. Michael LaMole says surgeons successfully removed some bone fragments without complication.
Within a few hours of the surgery, she was waking up, and through the weekend, she came back to the same baseline she had been before the surgery, that same level of interaction she's been having with us, and that's all very good.
President Obama and the First Family helped paint a mural at a middle school today here in Washington. He said volunteering is a good way to observe Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
After a painful week where so many of us were focused on tragedy, it's good for us to remind ourselves of what this country's all about.
And the former Peace Corps director and vice presidential nominee Sergeant Shriver has been hospitalized in Maryland in critical condition. He was George McGovern's running mate in 1972. More at MSNBC.com. I'm Pete Williams, NBC News Radio.
The Home Depot has made a special buy on Glidden paint. For just 4 days, 1 gallon cans of premium interior flat start at just $12.97. Well, there's a bright idea for your long weekend, spreading your money further to spread color all over your home. We're lowering the cost of new rooms with a special buy on Glidden paint starting at just $12.97 for just 4 days. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. Valid through January 17th, U.S. only. See store for details.
Hi, I ordered flowers for my wife.
Oh, right here, sir. I've got 2 dozen long-stemmed roses with white lilies in a beautiful crystal vase. An excellent choice.
Thanks. So how much do I owe you?
Oh, it's free.
Free?
That's right.
Well, happy anniversary to me.
Free is better. Do your simple federal return for free at TurboTax.com. It's free to prepare, free to print, and free to e-file. No wonder TurboTax is the most trusted brand of tax software in America. Visit TurboTax.com today. Trusted brand claim based on Intuit Commission Survey, August 2010.
A persistent problem facing all government agencies today is disposal of their confidential documents or other sensitive material. The best solution is turning your confidential files into energy. That's right, energy. Get clean and go green with Energy Recovery Operations on Aberdeen Proving Ground in Edgewood, Maryland. Since 1988, Energy Recovery has destroyed all sorts of government confidential records and magnetic media while producing energy. There is complete destruction. Do the green thing. Turn your government confidential records into energy. Go to EnergyRecoveryOnline.com or call 410-679-6200. Your mission is possible. Stop identity theft. Burn your government-sensitive records. Log on to EnergyRecoveryOnline.com or call 410-679-6200. That's EnergyRecoveryOnline.com. This message will self-destruct in 3 seconds. 3, 2, 1.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
NASA's Kepler mission has confirmed the discovery of its first rocky planet, named Kepler-10b. It's 1.4 times the size of Earth, making it the smallest planet ever found outside our solar system. Team leaders at NASA's Ames Research Center in California say it's also the first solid evidence of a rocky planet orbiting a star other than our sun. The size of the exoplanet can be derived from periodic dips in brightness. Kepler's ultra-precise photometer measures the tiny decrease in a star's brightness that happens when a planet crosses in front of it. The time measured between dips in brightness measures the distance between the planet and star. A result of the new analysis is the Kepler-10 star is now one of the most well-characterized planet-hosting stars in the universe.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Profile America, Monday, January 17th. What do earmuffs, water skis, and popsicles have in common? The answer is they were all invented by youngsters. Each year, young people come up with 500,000 gadgets and games. That's why this is Kid Inventors Day. The day was chosen to honor one of the nation's first inventors, Benjamin Franklin, who invented the first swim fins at age 12. The ingenuity of young people is being celebrated at events all across the nation, many of them showcasing the ideas of kid inventors. Each year, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office grants about 185,000 patents, 85% for inventions. About 13% are granted to individuals, the rest to U.S. and foreign corporations. You can find these and more facts about America,
from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is former CIA Director James Woolsey, and we've been talking so far in the program about alternative energy sources and the implications for national security. As we were talking about during the break, this conversation has evolved to be a lot more, first of all, frankly, a lot more sensible to people. I told General Wald on Friday when we were talking about the same topic, if he and I had had the same conversation even 5 years ago about the fact that the military, the Marines, were carrying solar panels into the combat zone in Afghanistan, people would have said, what kind of wackos have taken over the Marine Corps? And now people look on it as something that appears to be very wise. It's saving a lot of money and it's saving lives because there are fewer people that have to be involved in logistics carrying that fuel into the combat zone. What does that tell you about where we're headed potentially in this conversation?
I think the military's conversion over the course of the last few years to being really serious about getting off petroleum-based fuels and moving toward renewable energy for electricity generation is one of the most positive developments the country and indeed the world has seen. Once the American military gets a bit in its teeth and starts moving on something, lots of other things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Their interest in moving away from the electric grid is because of vulnerability. The grid is highly vulnerable to hacking, and it's highly vulnerable to terrorist attacks on, say, on transformers. And the military doesn't have a separate grid. One place in California has its own solar, China Lake has its own geothermal system that in normal times it exports electricity to Los Angeles. But pretty much every other military base in the country is on the electric grid. So like everybody else, they're a few days to a few weeks of generator fuel away from shutting down completely. And mm-hmm. this country has 18 critical infrastructures, including water and sewage and so forth. All 17 of the others depend on electricity, and the electricity is almost all the grid. So the military has started moving out smartly, partially because of deployed forces such as in Afghanistan, being able to have solar panels instead of schlepping kerosene out there or diesel fuel to run generators is a big plus. And being able to use alternative liquid fuels so you're not so dependent on the Gulf. All of those are very positive developments in the military in the last, particularly about the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Number of members of uniformed members of the military, very high level people have told me on and off the record, we've been pushing for this for a long time. It's not been as easy as we would like to get the civilian personnel to go along with this. You have experience, obviously, in the Navy in particular, having served there.
I know the Navy better. They and the Marine Corps have really moved out smartly on the alternative fuels. They're hoping by 2020 to have half of their fuel for transport and combat equipment, ships, aircraft, et cetera, be renewable. They have a long head start because mm-hmm. Their major ships, the carriers and the submarines, are nuclear. But when you add aggressive use of diesel from alternative sources for and for aviation fuel from like algae, they may well make it, and that's a laudable goal.
I want to shift gears a little bit here and draw on your experience as Director of Central Intelligence when we come back from this break. The WikiLeaks scandal has caused a little bit of an upheaval, well, a lot of an upheaval, I'm sure, in the intelligence community, but especially when it comes to personnel. And I want to talk about the effect of that on personnel and recruiting a new generation of intelligence professionals with you when we come back. My guest is former CIA Director James Woolsey on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Fed Cloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the Fed Cloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the Fed Cloud blog on Twitter. The Fed Cloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Are you looking for a smarter, simpler way to save? Now you can get the benefits of paper savings bonds without the paper. It's easy to plan for your financial future with Treasury Direct, a secure, convenient, web-based system where you can purchase electronic savings bonds and other Treasury securities online 24/7. Build your savings by scheduling recurring purchases directly from your paycheck, checking, or savings account. Change how you save today. Visit treasurydirect.gov to open your free account.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris. Weekday morning, 6 to 10.
We're talking with Tom Hicks. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy.
Part of the Secretary's goals is that by 2020, half of our energy will come from alternative sources. And so by that timeline, and based on our working with industry, we feel that the fuels will be competitively priced with petroleum at that point, and we'll be able to use those as drop-in replacements into our ships, into our aircraft.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the former Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, my guest for the hour. And you have, of course, heard everything ad nauseum about WikiLeaks over the last couple of months, I'm sure. One of the elements of that that I don't think has been explored is the reticence, potentially, of people who are very talented and very gifted and potentially have a lot to offer the intelligence community in the United States, to join that community because of the potential that one bad actor or a group of bad actors might reveal what they're doing, their personal lives and their professional lives. What are some of the dangers as when it comes to recruiting the talent that we need to continue the work of the Central Intelligence Agency and the other intelligence agencies? And what can we do about making that line of work attractive and overcoming those objections so people will want to do it?
Well, technology has put us all in a real bind on this because you want to share with those who need to be shared with and can make a contribution in limited numbers, and you want to do it across stovepipes in the government. But on the other hand, as I was pointing out to people when they kept talking about how everything will be fixed if we just share, the CIA shared a lot with Ames, and Ames shared a lot with the Russians, and the FBI shared a lot with Hansen, and Hansen shared a lot with the Russians. So it's not a, an elementary school sandbox. Sharing is not the only virtue. You need to operate the system in such a way that you technologically enforce need to know. Now, to the intelligence community's credit, they were not in the CIPRNet went so haywire when it got into the hands of an 18-year-old private first class, apparently. The CIPRNet is kind of a small version at a secret and below level of the internet, the principles of which are essentially everybody shares with everybody, and the barriers against sharing are difficult to construct in the internet, and they're difficult to construct in CIPRNet. So you need to work really hard to find a technological solution. Whereas if there's one person in DIA and one person in the National Reconnaissance Office and two people at CIA who need to work together on something, the organizational structure is not a barrier, but they and only they get the relevant material. And they can't download it into a thumb drive and say that they're, recording music. They don't get it if they're an 18-year-old PFC. Not all of us made the best decisions of our lives when we were 18.
Mm-hmm. I can certainly attest to that one. Technologically, as you say, we're in an environment where so many things are possible that weren't possible 5-10 years ago. I talk to CIOs at agencies all across government on a regular basis in this job, and they're all telling me the same thing. We're spending a lot of money on training. We're spending a lot of money on the technology. And as long as the human element is there, there's still going to be the possibility of things like this happening. And yet there still seems to be some risk mitigation that doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, the State Department trusted the Defense Department, which ran CIPRNet, by putting all its cables on the network, and maybe they assumed that somebody was going to look after security in an adequate fashion, and then it didn't happen. I don't know exactly what the inter-bureaucratic relationships were on that, but you can't run a network of classified material in such a way that pretty much anybody who gets on it, if he's even a moderately skilled hacker, can figure out how to download anything on it. It's just crazy. Mm-hmm. We really need to make some corrections to the way the internet works so that it isn't operating that way. But a classified smaller network of hundreds of thousands of members, any one of whom, if he had a little bit of hacking experience, probably could have done what the private first class did.
Mm-hmm.
Is crazy. You just can't operate that way.
Are we set up structurally to produce the kind of talent that we need in the intelligence community for the next 50 years or so?
I think we're set up to produce the talent. The organization and the policies have to be worthy of the people. They are able to be very selective in the intelligence community now. They have lots of very, very smart, able people applying. And if you go out there and walk around the CIA, it looks a bit like the United Nations now. I've got a lot of first-generation Americans from all sorts of different parts of the world, and that's good. I mean, it one really needs to be able to operate under non-official cover and to actually appear to be, possibly because you were born there, a Lebanese who speaks with a Lebanese accent rather than somebody who looks like me or looked like me from Oklahoma and WASP, mm-hmm. and trying to pass as a yeah. Lebanese smuggler along the Syrian border. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah.
I could have passed as a diplomat,
mm-hmm.
and as long as you're operating under official cover, that's you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to penetrate a terrorist group or something, you're not going to do it under diplomatic cover.
Yeah. What do you think is the biggest step that we could take toward trying to make sure that core of people that we need continues to come out of our colleges, universities, and other sources?
Well, I think the agency, CIA is the one I know the best on this, is doing a pretty good job of reaching out to the universities and getting people interested, and they have a pretty tough screen to get through. But if you're a native speaker of a language that they need badly, and you do very well in school, and you seem psychologically fit and so forth to undertake these kinds of responsibilities, which are often given very major responsibilities to relatively young people in the intelligence community, I think you've got a potentially fascinating, important, and challenging career. The real question is, can the government, I think, keep up with things like its security systems, with the obligations that it has to people that are as extraordinary as the ones coming into the intelligence community?
And HR people tell me that the component of personnel that gets lost is the retention element. We focus a lot on bringing new people in, mm-hmm. and don't spend enough time and energy thinking about keeping the good people that we have.
You can't run everything with 26-year-olds. Mm-hmm. You really need a spectrum, absolutely.
Yeah. James Woolsey is the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Talk just for a moment before we go to break about what you're doing today.
I'm a venture partner in a venture capital fund, Lux Capital in New York, finding companies in renewable energy and other high technology areas. And I'm teaching a course on energy at Yale. It's called Energy in the 21st Century. Could Muir, Patton, and Gandhi agree?
Fascinating title and a fascinating discussion. Today, of course, is Martin Luther King Day. We're celebrating the life of Dr. King. And you had an interesting story that you told me about an experience with a very famous moment in American history. And we'll talk about that when we come back from the break and wrap up my conversation with James Woolsey on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be back in a moment.
Profile America, Monday, January 17th. What do earmuffs, water skis, and popsicles have in common? The answer is they were all invented by youngsters. Each year, young people come up with 500,000 gadgets and games. That's why this is Kid Inventors Day. The day was chosen to honor one of the nation's first inventors, Benjamin Franklin, who invented the first swim fins at age 12. The ingenuity of young people is being celebrated at events all across the nation, many of them showcasing the ideas of kid inventors. Each year, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office grants about 185,000 patents, 85% for inventions. About 13% are granted to individuals, the rest to U.S. and foreign corporations. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and AVU Technologies. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Join AGA for its National Leadership Conference, February 17th and 18th at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. AGA will bring together government, financial, management, and accountability leaders to share valuable insight, proven strategies, lessons learned. Sessions over current issues relating to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the effects of political transitions, and what the future holds. Show your commitment to a more accountable future. Register today at agacgfm.org/NLC.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Just a few moments left with my guest, James Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence And as I mentioned before the break, today is Martin Luther King Day, and you told a terrific story before we went on the air about an experience that you had about something that is really on people's minds today.
Well, in 1963, I was a summer intern in the State Department, just graduated from college, and I volunteered to do some work in evenings and otherwise with the Congress on Racial Equality. And I was asked to be one of the marshals for the March on Washington. It was a very hot day. We didn't have anything to do except to go get stretchers for people who'd had heat stroke or heat exhaustion. It was late in the afternoon, really hot. And most of the people there were in their Sunday best, hats and coats and ties and so forth. And a lot of them were seated down around the reflecting pool, some feet in the water, hats off, coats off, listening to the speakers. And when I was standing about 100 feet from where King was when he gave the speech, and as they introduced him, without anybody saying anything, all over the reflecting pool area and all over the area down toward the Washington Monument, where people couldn't even see him, people started standing up, all of them, did up their ties and put on their hats and put on their coats and stood quietly in respect. And I've always said that's your definition of leadership. If on a hot August afternoon, when people can't even see you, they introduce you, and people stand up and get themselves sort of dressed up just for the honor of listening to you, that's a leader.
That's a tremendous story. James Woolsey telling that. We talked a lot in this conversation today about renewable energy. We have about a minute and a half left. What closing thought should we know about renewable energy that gives us hope for the future?
It needs a companion. And the best companion, I think, is natural gas, because gas is getting cheaper and more plentiful through the shale formations, much more widely available. U.S. reserves have radically increased over the course of just the last year or two. Gas can be enlarged. You can use large generators or small ones. So it can mate up in a way with renewables. And on a cloudy day like today, when the sun's not shining, you turn on the natural gas, and if you've got bright sunshine and you have solar panels, you can turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a natural alliance between the natural gas people and those of us who are interested in renewables, and we really ought to work together so we don't have to use as much coal, which is dirty in a lot of ways, and we can move for electricity generation toward renewables and gas, and I think for liquid fuels away from oil and toward alternative liquid fuels from biomass and other sources, as well as electricity and improved efficiency of internal combustion engines. Electricity helps a lot, because driving on electricity, you do for a quarter to a fifth the cost of operating costs that you drive on gasoline. And that makes it really hard for the Saudis to turn on the pumps and drop the bottom out of the market and knock people out of the market the way they did in the mid-'80s and again to some extent in the 90s. So electricity for vehicles kind of helps protect the other improvements that we need to make.
As I suspected when we first discussed having you come on the program, there is a lot more to talk about than there is time to talk about it, so I would love to have you come back and continue this conversation.
I'd be delighted.
The former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, James Woolsey, my guest for the hour on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You can find our conversation archived later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The Dora Beck Insider is up next, and I'm back tomorrow at 1 with former Pentagon official Rudy De Leon for tomorrow's Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.